Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of February 28th, 2014. This week on the show, how do you talk to your kids about money? Can a preschooler learn to save at the same time they're learning to count? Plus, this extra cold winter froze cash flow as well as hands and feet. But we're going to start with the cryptocurrency Bitcoin. Imagine if a currency, even an entire way of thinking about money, was suddenly threatened. That's what happened this week when the largest exchange for trading Bitcoin went down. Customers couldn't get their money out of the Tokyo-based exchange called Mt. Gox. And then on Friday, Mt. Gox declared bankruptcy, casting even more uncertainty over what's next. Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to the Bitcoin world. Welcome back, Ben.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Walk me through what happened with Mt. Gox.
Well, it's still a little bit of a mystery, but basically the website has been having some hacking problems over the past month. And this past weekend, the website basically started to go dark. And this week it went dark. It went offline. The website was showing a blank page. There was apparently another theft at the site of a huge number of Bitcoin, like 6% of all the Bitcoin out there in the world. And there's not a lot we know more than that, except that a lot of people are worried about their Bitcoin.
Let's say you have money in Bitcoin and you had it in Mt. Gox. This is the biggest of these exchanges. Can those people get their money back?
I think we're in a wait and see time right now. Here's the problem. Mt. Gox, website based in Japan. And furthermore, not FDIC insured, we should note. So basically, you've got a lot of people here in the U.S. who have Bitcoin hosted at Mt. Gox. I don't think they have much recourse right now. You're looking at an international lawsuit situation. Maybe Japanese authorities so far seem to be loath to involve themselves in this issue. And so I think we don't quite know yet.
Basically, we're talking about a run on the bank, but unlike a traditional bank, there's no government insurance backstop here. As you said, no FDIC, no one's going to step in and say, all right, we're guaranteeing that you can take your money out. What does that mean for the future of Bitcoin or for other cryptocurrencies that are like it? After all, these have become wildly popular in a short period of time.
I think there are a couple things that we should think about. First of all, Bitcoin may not be the future of cryptocurrency. That's what its detractors would say. They would say, look, this Mt. Gox situation, this is highly volatile. It's an unregulated currency. It doesn't have a lot of government support. People don't fully understand it. Bitcoin, its days may be numbered. I do think that there is a future in cryptocurrency. And if we want to get a little bit of a hint about that, we should look at the fact that a lot of banking institutions are very interested in this. Congress has looked at Bitcoin and the issue of cryptocurrencies. JP Morgan, in the past few months, actually filed a patent for its own cryptocurrency. So I do think there's a future for cryptocurrencies because there's a lot of interest there.
All right, Ben, the last time we had you on the show, we were talking about Bitcoin. And one of the things we talked about is using it as an investment, whether people could make money. We basically said yes. Were we wrong?
I don't think we were wrong, but, you know, people should really understand that this is a very risky investment. It is a gamble. Like any gamble that you make, when you invest in something, the price of which may actually change, and in this case, change drastically. Think of an ATM connected to your bank account. One day you've got $5,000 in your bank account. The next day you've only got $2,000 and you can't get your money out. So I think that there are some definite risks involved. You still can make money off your investment, but there are questions about regulation and how you might have that money be insured or protected so that you can actually hold on to it.
So it's both the same kind of risk you'd have trading a foreign currency, but also the risk of an infrastructure system that is much more volatile than just about any other one.
Absolutely. And many people would say that's because it's basically unregulated. It's not protected by the government. It's not protected by your bank. As we said before, it's not FDIC insured. So that's the problem.
Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech, thank you for coming on.
Thank you, Lizzie.
you were hoping for a quick end to this brutal winter, bad news. It just keeps coming. Snow and cold from polar vortex storms have closed roads, schools, and stores. One firm estimates that this winter has cost businesses about $15 billion. There are costs for consumers, too. We have two reporters from two very cold places. Paula Wethington writes for the Monroe News in Michigan and runs the blog Monroe on a Budget. We also have John Brewer with us. He's at the Pioneer Press in St. Paul, Minnesota. Welcome to you both.
Hi.
Hey.
All right, we're talking Michigan and Minnesota. These are not places where winter is unusual, but is this winter rougher than most, Paula?
Absolutely. The Detroit and Toledo news media are talking about records just shattering that have been held since 1977, 78. Those were blizzard years in the region. As far as Monroe, we would normally see about 42 inches of snow each season. So far, 65 inches, and winter's not done yet.
John, what are you hearing about what's unusual this year, and how does that affect what people are paying for in and around the Twin Cities?
There's the cost of your soul being crushed, I think. is part of it. But, you know, it's the extreme cold we've been having. Getting your battery replaced in your car is a big one, having your driveway plowed. And for the city of St. Paul, an average year, we have four snow emergencies, which is when they clear all the streets of snow. They take 2 days. It's really intensive. It costs about $500,000 on average per snow emergency for the city. This year, we've had eight, and we potentially could have more. So add to that, if you were unfortunate enough to leave your car on the street when they declare a snow emergency, you get towed, impounded. That's going to cost you $275 to get your car back. And so far this year, 5,542 vehicles have been towed during snow emergencies.
Yeah. Wow.
Paul, you write a personal finance column. What are some of the costs that you've been hearing from your readers this year?
One of the biggest things is just dealing with the numbers of days that the kids have been home from school. We would normally have anywhere from 3 to 4 snow days per school year. One of the school districts in my area has taken 17 days off so far this year. They're going to have to make it up. But for the immediate impact, now the kids are home all day. You're lucky if you can get your daycare to be open. Now you're paying, instead of latch day fees, you're paying full day daycare fees. Or you've got parents who have to take the days off work. Most of the time, that's going to be eaten into your vacation time, or you're taking his unpaid day off. You just got to eat the cost. There's no way around it.
John, I gather you polled your readers on Facebook about what's costing them the most.
For sure.
Of that is what they've been driving into, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. Potholes. That's the word of the week here. Most of our streets are heavily rutted. One guy called something he ran into a chasm in the earth, and it ended up flattening his tire, bending the rim. It's going to cost him $500. I talked to a mechanic down the road from our newspaper. He said they've been having a ton of folks come in with bent tie rods, cars bottom out, and prices can go up to $1,800 for repair. He said that's sort of on the high end, but it's going to be like that all over the city. So a lot of folks are shelling out dough for car repairs.
Yeah, one of my friends posted a very lovely picture on his Facebook page the other day of a tire that was eaten by a pothole in Michigan.
Eaten. That's pretty much it. These things are, they're not inanimate. They have a will to destroy your car.
How do you climb out to the other side of this? Because these are the kind of costs that people don't anticipate going into a normal winter. What have people been doing to try to recoup some of that money?
Oh, good question. My husband had to replace the battery on his car. I had to get a new pair of boots. You just have to manage the best you can. Hope you have an emergency fund. Hope you got room on your credit card. And just cut back everywhere else just to make sure the bills get paid on time. You have to do that.
John, have your readers started to see this show up in their utility bills yet? I'd imagine that it can be pretty costly to try to keep a house warm.
It is. And just personally, our bill jumped a couple $100 from January to February. What you hope for, though, is that you can make up for that by cutting your air conditioning in the summer. We do actually get hot enough here to turn on the AC. But yeah, it's hitting everybody pretty hard. You know, I'm sure you've heard about the propane shortages, people having to meter out their heating fuel. It's not been an easy winter.
When you look at the cities where you both live, I'd imagine there's some economic damage that goes beyond just your individual pocketbooks, but costs that school systems or communities are going to have to bear. What's the wider economic impact of this weather?
Well, our County Road Commission has pretty much blew their budget really quick early in the season. We're still waiting to see how this is all going to settle out. But is going to have to be dealt with. How is the county going to keep the roads open as best as possible? Because without that, people cannot get to school and work. You know, we did have some small businesses that shut down during the worst of the winter weather. Hair salons, some doctor's offices. You know, there was no money coming in for those small businesses because they couldn't get their clients and customers processed.
And John?
Hospitals are going to have to prepare for a baby boom 9 months. Yeah, in St. Paul, the city budgets on the calendar year. So we just started this year. There's plenty of money from the right-of-way assessments. That's what goes towards the plowing and sanding and salting of the road. So the city told me yesterday that they're still in good shape right now. They're still paying the bills. But if this winter goes on a lot longer and next winter, you know, December is rough, that's when we're going to really see the pinch here and going to have to figure out ways to cover our costs. Winter starts pretty early here, so that's really possible.
John Brewer is a reporter with the Pioneer Press in Minnesota's Twin Cities, and Paula Wethington is with the Monroe News in Michigan. Thank you both so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
We always keep the conversations we have on Marketplace Money going online, so we're going to check in with our digital producer, Raghu Manavalan, to see what folks are telling us on Twitter about their weather headaches. Hi, Raghu.
Hi, Lizzie.
What are we hearing so far?
Well, Diami Plotke sent us this tweet, which really exemplified what people are going through. He said the weather hits his wallet because of oil prices going up, his employees because of their inability to work, and his cash flow because of his inability to bill customers. We got a picture from Andrew K. Johnson about one of those evil potholes that you mentioned earlier in your interview.
That eats cars.
That eats cars. You should see this picture. I'm not sure if it's a tire or Play-Doh or what, but he said it costs more than $200 to fix. And then NB Do, last month, electricity bill was 33% higher than last year. So there are a lot of different ways this is affecting people.
We're always collecting what you have to say about this show and about all the other topics we cover.
Yeah, you can tweet at us at LiveMoney, or you can go to our website at MarketplaceMoney.org.
Later in the show, comedian Maria Bamford opens up about her family's financial history.
My dad was a saver, so we did have a lot of powdered milk. The thermostat was at 50. He said, get a sweater, and it was chilly.
But first, personal finance expert Jill Schlesinger and I answer your questions. That's next on Marketplace Money from APM. This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. And this is the part of the show where we talk to you, our listeners, about how you live money. Today, I am joined by Jill Schlesinger. She's a CBS News business analyst and the host of Jill on Money. She's also a frequent contributor here. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so we're going to start with our first caller, who is Caitlin in Burlington, Vermont. Caitlin, tell us a little bit about yourself. I know you are thinking about buying a home, but give me a broader picture of your income. I know you're married, kind of the money that's coming in and what your financial thoughts are.
I live in Burlington, and my husband and I both work, and our annual combined income is about $90,000. And we've saved up about $20,000 to put a down payment on a house with, and we've gotten pre-approved. But I've also just gotten into grad school. And the cost of that for a year-long program is going to be about the same as the money we've saved up.
So, and what's that program for?
It's an MBA, so it's a Master of Business, and it's sustainable entrepreneurship, which is kind of exciting.
What does that mean?
Well, it's taking into account the triple bottom line, so it's thinking about not just how you can make yourself a better business, but also a better business for the environment and for the people who you hire.
And so basically it sounds like these two things would cost not exactly equivalent, but roughly equivalent here. And your question is somewhere along the lines of what's the better bang for your buck in terms of taking out a loan for school versus using that money towards a house? Is that a pretty accurate read on it?
Exactly. So we were thinking of buying a house in the near future, but when we saw that I could basically pay for my grad school up front, I thought, well, maybe I should do that. But then we'd have to wait another few years before we had the money saved up again to think about a house. So the question is, do we keep sort of pouring money into rent, which isn't getting us anywhere, or do I take out a loan for the grad school?
Can I ask you how old you are?
27.
Oh, you're young.
Oh, so nice. Can I jump in? What do you do
here
now?
Here goes Jill.
Here
good,
comes Jill.
Good Look luck, out. Caitlin.
Sorry. No, I'm going to be very gentle. Relax. Okay. So what do you do now for
I work for a nonprofit right now.
Do you think that by earning this MBA, is this a one-year or two-year program?
It's just a one-year.
So do you think that this will result in you earning a lot more money once you have this credential?
Well, my hope is that I'll be earning at least as much as I am now, but the idea is to earn more or at least advance in what I want to do, because the jobs that I'm looking at now are all sort of on the same level, and I'd like to be able to sort of step it up a notch.
Aha. Uh-huh. So in other words, that MBA would help you step up the career ladder.
Right. In fact, the board members on this program are all members of organizations that I would love to work for.
Well, all right. So listen, I have to say I'm always skeptical about advanced degrees, mostly because everyone who does not have an advanced degree says they're not worth anything. So I'm one of those people who doesn't have an advanced degree. But I'm not saying that for you, because if you're telling me you can make a big step, either not just even in money, but over the long term, then I am more inclined to buy into the idea of doing this. Will you? So this is a full-time program?
It is. And I, you know, I've thought a lot about whether to go back to school or not. And I like this program for a number of reasons. One, because it's in-state, so I get a much lower tuition than a lot of the other MBA programs.
Yeah.
Two, because it does have sort of the type of people who I end up wanting to work for there, so they can hopefully see me and offer me a job at the end of it. And three, because it is just 1 year long, I don't feel like I'll be out of the workforce that long, so it's not such a huge commitment of my time.
And so can you and your husband kind of float your bills on one income if you were to go to the program?
It would be tight, but we would be able to, I think.
I'm in. I'm totally convinced. You just turned me around. You're telling me the story. I had a frown. You made my frown turn into a smile. I think look, don't deplete the money that you have, all the emergency reserve that you have. I would delay the house purchase.
Well, that's where we were going next. So Jill, your read on this is keep renting while going to grad school.
Yep, keep renting. Don't make yourself crazy. Wait. Replenish the house down payment. I wouldn't even borrow money. If I didn't have to, I wouldn't borrow money for grad school. I mean, if you need to, don't deplete all of your money. In other words, if this 20 grand that you have for that save for the house is in addition to your emergency reserve fund, then I would say, okay, I'm going to use that. I'm going to pay for the grad school. We'll have to go ahead and rebuild, delay the home purchase for a couple years. And hopefully, by the way, in a couple of years, you're earning more, you're able to save more, and I think that that's maybe a more prudent approach. I think it would be awfully hard to do them both at the same time. I really do.
Well, that's not what I was hoping to hear.
Oh, you want to do everything.
I do. Well, I was thinking, well, maybe I'll just get the loans out, you know, and then I'll be able to also get the house so that we're not throwing the rental money away.
But then you will be calling in 3 years and telling us that you are being hamstrung by debt. And what, by the way, happens if all of a sudden you're living this, you know, great life in Burlington, you get this awesome MBA, and then someone in New Hampshire wants to hire you, and you've bought a house in Burlington, and actually you've got a much better opportunity one state or two states over. Don't you think it makes sense to trade that, you know, dream house concept for a little more flexibility, at least in the near term?
I guess.
Oh, she hates me. Lizzie, rescue me.
Since you're only talking about a year program, I think one of the questions that you want to ask yourself is, how much does a year change where you are financially and what you and your husband's goals are? And if a year means you get that MBA and then you can revisit the house question in a year, that's not that long.
Even if it's 2 years or 3 years, she hates me right now. I'm just, look, you're going to do what you want to do, okay? So I know this is just sort of, you know, two chicks talking on the radio, and I don't want to go crazy here. I just think that often if you take on a big burden early in your life, it may curtail your options in the intermediate and long term. And I'd hate for that to happen. You're doing something that's a risk, but it's a really good risk. You're betting on yourself and you're saying, I have the money to do it. And all I'm asking you to do is to say, okay, I believe in you too, but I don't want you to necessarily go into debt and be, taking on so many obligations that you are unable to actually cash in when the opportunity arrives.
Caitlin, will you keep us posted about what you decide and whether or not you walk out of here and think Jill is just mean?
Oh, such a bad person.
Well, it's mean but useful. And I think you... It's common sense, and it's just hard to see it when you do want to take everything on at once. So I appreciate the advice.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for calling, and please let us know what you decide.
I will. Thank you very much for your advice. I appreciate it.
We got an email, and I don't know, I like to think of it as our barter economy question. So this is from Leah in Alabama, and she owns a two-bedroom townhouse. In the past, she's had a roommate where she charged a certain amount for rent plus half the utilities. She's got the chance now for someone to move in, and in lieu of paying money for part of the rent, this person is willing to do chores around the house and projects to pay off a portion of the rent. Leah likes the concept, but she also likes the idea of maybe having a lease, wants to know how this could be spelled out. What do you think?
This is interesting. I kind of like this idea because maybe Leah doesn't actually need the cash flow. I mean, so we're presuming she doesn't if she's willing to do this. And maybe Leah even pays someone to do some of the chores, or she's tired of doing them herself. So I think this is kind of a neat idea. It's sort of like saying I have a live-in nanny and, you know, I partially pay for some of this in straight-up cash, and part of it is room and board, right? And so I think you can have a contract. I don't know if you will have a lawyer necessary to draft it, but a simple contract that says what your expectations are for what the roommate will be doing. And if it's, you know, you will be the person responsible for, I would, in the Northeast, I'd say snow removal. In the South, I would say, I don't know, leaf stuff, outdoors, gardening, cleaning. But spell it out. And as long as you are very clear about what your expectations are, it would seem to me kind of a neat little deal here.
All right. Cool. Jill, can you stick around with us? We've got more callers just on the other side of the break.
Absolutely.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and I'm back with Jill Schlesinger. We're going to take another call now. This is from Jane in Asheville, North Carolina. Jane, you've got a pretty complicated financial situation. You own two homes with your husband, but it sounds like you guys are ready to downsize to something smaller than your current primary house. Can you explain kind of your situation for us?
Yes, and it is complicated. So we live in our current home, which is, you know, built in 1919. It's in a historical neighborhood. We bought it for about $86,000, but we could probably, if we were to put it on the market today, get about $450,000 for it.
Wow.
We also own a lot adjacent to the property where we want to build a new home, downsize, you know, make it energy efficient, that kind of thing. So what complicates it a little bit more is I'm losing my job at the end of June. Mm-hmm. So our current mortgage payment is $945 a month, and we owe $103,000 on that mortgage. So basically, we were wondering, should we go ahead and sell the house, use the proceeds of the house to build the new house, or should we use our cash that we have? We've got about $220,000 in cash that we could use to get rolling on the new construction, or possibly even take out a construction loan.
Well, let me ask you a couple of things. So my understanding is your husband is retired, is that right?
That's correct.
And so what kind of monthly income will be coming in once you're not working?
That will be Social Security, and I'm anticipating getting unemployment, and I'm not sure how much that would be. So, you know, the monthly income, you know, it would cover the mortgage, but certainly not our living expenses. So I think what we would definitely like to do is pay off the mortgage once my job ends, mm-hmm. so that we won't have that $945 payment each month. You know, I don't know if I'm going to immediately get another position or if I'll be unemployed for a while. It's just one big unknown right now.
So, hi, this is Jill. You said you have $220,000 in cash just hanging around? That's impressive.
Well, it was actually part of an inheritance.
Aha.
And we weren't really sure what we were going to do. We haven't had it all that long, so we're just a little bit stumped whether to use it for the construction, invest it, pay off the mortgage. We're just really uncertain right now.
And do you have a retirement account that you're going to need to roll over from your old employer, your soon-to-be old employer?
I do, but it's not substantial.
How much?
It's a small. There's only about $3,000 in it currently.
So is this $220,000 really all the money you have in the world besides the real estate?
We've got about $60,000 in an IRA and in investments. And then we've also got a property in Mexico, which, you know, that's something else to consider is we're hoping to spend part of our time in Mexico and rent out the new property.
So this is really, I mean, it sounds like you guys are really shifting the kind of lifestyle you want to live to a more retirement-focused lifestyle.
I think so. You know, I'll always be working, but I'd like to, you know, whatever I do next, I hope it's a situation where I've got more flexibility so that we could take time and, you know, spend a few months out of the year down in Mexico.
Hmm. Well, I'm going to let Jill do the math. I see her making little notes over there in brightly colored ink.
Exactly. It's scary. Okay. So here's what I think. I think that, you know, you have a lot of real estate and you have a lot of equity in that real estate. So given my druthers, if I could wave my financial wand over your lives, I would have you sell the house that you are in and have that, you know, 350 grand that you net, or 335 after you pay everything. And I would use that to build my new home and hopefully not spend all of it on the new home, hopefully add a little bit of money. I would love it if you guys could come away with this, owning your home free and clear, but also keeping about $300,000 available in outside of your retirement accounts, because you don't have a lot of income. And you need liquidity. You need money that you're going to dip into. One thing I didn't ask is, how old are you?
52.
Yeah, you're young. You are young.
I'm young.
You're super young.
Thanks.
And so you're really young. And so, you know, we need to build up that nest egg so that it can, if you're really going to be shifting your lifestyle and your husband's already retired, you cannot take the risk of owning lots of property and not having it be liquid. And you really need to be careful about how much money you spend on the new house. You know, but building your own house is awesome, right? You make all these great decisions. It's a phenomenal process. But there is a reason they made the movie The Money Pit. I mean, it can be pretty daunting and things go over schedule. So if you can end up with, instead of a $450,000 house, a $250,000 house, I think you guys are going to be in much better shape. And that way, you know, if your husband's got Social Security and you're making part-time income and you own your house free and clear and you still have a nest egg, then I see a possibility here. But I think it's awfully and also, I'm not sure anyone's giving you a construction loan if you don't have income. I think that's, you know, it's almost be a moot point because there is no bank that's going to lend to you after June. You know, it's just impossible.
Right, unless we got the construction loan before June.
Yeah, but even that, you know, look at where we are now. It takes a long time to get a construction loan. It really does. And there's a reason why you wouldn't get it, which is it's a big risk. And you have that same risk. Right. So if that project takes a long time and you're burning through a lot of money and you don't have income, that's a dangerous prospect for people like you because you don't have a way to make it up fast.
So,
Jill, you're pro selling.
I always love selling because I think it's a much lower risk endeavor. And I think if you are moving into retirement and you really want to get a grip on your expenses, I think knowing what that nut is going to be, it makes your life a lot easier, Jane, when you're going out and looking for part-time income. And you might say, hey, you know what I really need? I need to make $2,000 a month. That's it. I don't need to make, you know, $90,000 a year and kill myself. That's what I need. And then you can figure it out very easily. But look, I would just hate it if you're sort of hanging around, letting things happen. The project goes, you know, over. You're spending lots of money. You need money. You need a nest egg to last you. You have 40 years ahead of you, hopefully. Okay? 40 years. We got to make your money last a long time. And to do that, we need to have a corpus, some amount of money that's going to be invested in growing and keeping pace with inflation. So I think it's a cool game plan, but be careful executing it.
That is sort of intuitively what I was thinking. But of course, if we do sell our house, we're going to have to rent another place, you know, until the new place is completed.
Right, but you're not paying the expenses of maintaining a house, and you're not paying the mortgage, and you're not paying, you know what I mean? So I think that there is some your costs will be lower. No doubt.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much. It's been really helpful.
Of course. Thank you for calling in. Take care. And Jill Schlesinger, CBS business analyst and the host of Jill on Money, thank you for being with us.
It was great to be with you.
We're a friendly bunch here at Marketplace Money, and we want to help you. Do you have a question about your money? Ask away at marketplacemoney.org. There you can send us an email or do the radio thing and leave us a message using your own voice. Or tweet us at Live Money. Coming up later in the show, a conversation with kids that can stump even the smartest adults.
They really do have some understanding of it. And when you think about it, you're exposed to money at a very, very, very young age. You're seeing your parents have transactions, and you may not see dollars, bills, and change anymore, but you're seeing plastic cards being given and cash coming out in return from machines.
How to talk to children about personal finance. That's next on Marketplace Money from APM. This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Starting this spring, students in Oklahoma will have to pass more than just your basic academic courses to graduate high school. They'll have to be proficient in personal finance as well. That means knowing the basics of savings, getting a loan, getting insurance, paying taxes, all that real-life money stuff. Students are taking classes and getting tested on it. Along with Oklahoma, several states require students to learn about personal finance. Dan Kadlec is a contributor for Time and writes about money and how we learn and teach it. Welcome to Marketplace Money.
Great to be here.
Oklahoma is requiring that students graduate with some fluency starting this spring in banking, taxes, investing, the kind of personal finance basics that people go out into the world with. Does it make a difference if you're taught that stuff in high school?
That's a big question, frankly, that a lot of smart people are trying to answer. I say yes, it makes a huge difference. There are people that say, show me the proof, and that's what advocates are working on right now. But yeah, it's inconceivable to me that you can't learn personal finance, and it's inconceivable to me that if you learn it, you won't act on it. The problem is we haven't been teaching it. It's a pretty new experiment, and I believe if we just stay with it for a while, the proof will come.
I looked at the numbers, and it looks like about 17 states require some type of personal finance course, and that comes from the Council of Economic Education, but only six require testing that knowledge. So what does that say, I guess, about our commitment to kind of figuring out what we're teaching?
And by the way, those numbers aren't going up. The last few studies I've looked at from the council, the numbers are kind of holding right where they are, a little up, a little down in some areas. So, no, we don't have a huge commitment to this. We really don't. And if you're not testing it, I mean, it's one thing to have standards. It's one thing to offer it. But it's quite another to make it mandatory and to test on it. You know, one of the oldest lines in education is if it's not tested, it's not taught. And, you know, this is no different. And teachers aren't really going to hop on board until they really almost have to and they can see the value.
personal finance is such an important life skill. You can't navigate the world without figuring out how to make a budget and pay your rent. Why do you think we don't teach it in school?
Well, we don't teach it because traditionally we haven't taught it. Traditionally, it's been taught in the home. And traditionally, you know, the government and employers have created a safety net for us that it wasn't quite as important as it is today. Young people today are going to work and then retire into a world where they're entirely on their own. The game has changed, but the educational system is lagging. There's no question in my mind that eventually we're going to get around to it. You know, the UK just recently instituted mandatory financial ed. Australia is doing this as well. A bunch of countries are on board, and they're all moving that way. And we have a big problem in this country because education is at the state level. It's dictated at the state level. We can't just have the education secretary say we're doing something and then do it. The states need to be brought along.
The flip side of this is a study that came out last year from Harvard Business School that said they found additional training in math leads to greater financial market participation, so that maybe you could get there with a math or an economics class and you didn't need personal finance.
It's a big part of personal finance. Another big part of personal finance, though, is psychology, which math doesn't help you with. It's a question of being educated generally seems to be enough to get you to help you navigate these waters.
You've written about the idea of point of sale financial education, where maybe you're about to sign the loan and then you get help making that decision. But that's not really how we go out into the world. You can't have a teacher with you all the time. Does point-of-sale education work?
No. And how are you going to deliver point-of-sale information? And what does point-of-sale information mean in terms of retirement planning? You need to start saving when you're 18, not at 65 when the point-of-sale is I'm going to retire. So it just doesn't make any sense to me that is the only answer. It is proven that point of sale helps if you can get the advice and it's unbiased.
If you could design a financial education system, what would it look like?
It would start in pre-K with counting pennies, and it would go all the way through high school with understanding what a 401k is like and how compound interest works and why over 40 years it's actually pretty easy to save $1 million.
Dan Kadlec is a journalist and a regular contributor to Time. He's also the co-author of A New Purpose. Thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. You just heard about kids learning personal finance basics in school, but even before they're in class, children are hearing about money, what their parents spend it on, or just the concept of buying and paying for things. Beth Kobliner writes about kids and money and is a member of the President's Advisory Council on Financial Capability for Young Americans. Welcome to Marketplace Money.
Great to be here. Thanks.
I want to start with some real kids who we asked. These are preschoolers in Los Angeles. We asked them, where do your parents get money?
From the bank, a money box. I got one at my home. They go to work first, then they go to the bank.
I think money comes from when you don't like have money and you go buy food. If you don't have a house or you don't have food, the people give you money.
When you go to school and if you don't go to school anymore, you don't get any money. But when you do go to school, you get a lot of money.
They work so they can get money.
What is money?
Those are very young kids, but they clearly have some concept of this thing called money. How do you introduce a child to money?
Well, I love the money box concept. Don't we all need a little money box? But you're right. They really do have some understanding of it. And when you think about it, you're exposed to money at a very, very, very young age. You're
seeing your parents have transactions, and you may not see dollars, bills, and change anymore, but you're seeing plastic cards being given and cash coming out in return from machines. So talking about that in everyday experiences, when you go to the grocery store, I'm going to give them this card, and this card has some money in it. And because of that, we get to take home these vegetables or these cookies or whatever it is you're buying.
I think a lot of people think about kids and money, and they're thinking about an allowance or chores. But with really little kids, when do you start talking about money?
You can start with children as young as 2 and 3 years old. And there's research now that backs that up. We see that young, very, very young children understand concepts like value and exchange or choice. You can talk about, we go to the store and you have only $1. Do you spend it on 2 apples or 1 banana? Those kind of trade-offs are very good to start talking about really early.
We've got some real-life questions from listeners who wanted to know how to differentiate between the different ways to teach a kid and to motivate them. For example, a big one that's come up: an allowance versus payment for specific chores.
Right. This is the sort of big controversy out there when it comes to allowance. And I have to say, I looked at many studies, not only from the U.S., but Canada and Tokyo and Singapore. And the bottom line is there is no right answer. Some studies show that when you give kids allowance and you don't tie it toward chores, it's actually worse for the kids. But then you have the same number of studies, flip side, that if you give it for chores, either kids feel alienated from the family, they don't feel part of the group. The answer to that question is, if you feel like giving allowance to your kids, it's certainly a reasonable thing to do, but it's not the panacea. And if you can't sort of sort out the allowance situation, don't feel guilty about it.
What are some mistakes that you've seen parents make?
The thing I've seen that many parents do is lie. And it's sort of that knee-jerk response. You're in a store, your child wants to buy a candy bar or some toy that you don't think they need, and you say, well, I don't have any money. But then in the next breath, they see you take out your credit card and buy something else. And I think that really takes away from some of your credibility. The instinct of buying something for a child just to keep them quiet, if they're throwing a tantrum in the grocery store and they really want those Oreos, you buy it for them. And, you know, I've probably done each of these things wrong at some point or another. And then you learn as you go on.
When you think about your own kids, is there something you think, man, we really nailed this one? We got this one right.
I think that they have a good sense of you can't have everything you want. And I think now that two of the oldest are teenagers, I think they also realize they wouldn't want to get everything that they want in a funny way. That sort of life has a way of unfolding itself, and that they work hard for their accomplishments. And I think that they're intrinsically motivated. And I think that is one of the more gratifying things. I think if we were sort of forking out $5 bills here and there for grades, first of all, it would be very expensive by now that my daughter's a senior in high school. But also, I think it would sort of diminish some of their own accomplishments. And suddenly they're thinking about how much money they made by doing well on the SATs rather than just doing well and feeling that has a merit in its a value in its own way.
Probably the biggest ticket item in any family's budget is paying for college. When do you introduce that concept?
I think you could introduce that concept both early, when they're very, very young, just to talk about we have all kinds of goals as a family, and one might be a family vacation, and one might be a new car that we need, but we also have the goal of sending you to college. So you can talk about that as early as elementary school. Then when you're getting much closer, say 8th, 9th grade, I believe you can really start talking about affordability and how there are a lot of situations, there are a lot of variables that you're going to look at as a family when choosing a college. So I think there are different conversations that could start at different ages, but early is a good idea.
Beth Koebleiner writes about kids and money, and she's currently writing a book, Make Your Kid a Money Genius, Even If You're Not. Thank you for coming on the show.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks.
One way, of course, to teach kids about money is to give them an allowance. We asked you to tell us whether that approach works for you. And digital producer Raghu Madhavalan has been collecting your responses online.
Yeah, we threw out the same question that you discussed with Beth about, is it okay to give your kids an allowance? And 35% of our respondents said no, no allowance for kids.
Really? They prefer chores?
Yeah. The most common reasons we heard was that they would provide money if they felt the kid had earned it or it was for a good reason. They wouldn't just give it to them with no strings attached. Here's a pretty good quote that I saw in our survey. There are basic things kids should do because they are part of a family, a team, so to speak, and not just for money.
You can take that quiz and tell us how you talk to your kids about money. Online at Raghu. Go ahead and tee it up for us.
On Twitter at LiveMoney or on our website at MarketplaceMoney.org. We love hearing from you.
The conversation never stops. Raghu Madhavalan, our digital producer, thank you.
Thank you.
As we just heard, you're never too young to start your financial education. Of course, the learning curve is different for everyone, and so some of the financial lessons we're given early in life don't really sink in until much later. This week, we've got a funny woman from Minnesota reflecting on the money lessons she learned from her spiritual upbringing and how they shaped her spending habits.
My name is Maria Bamford. I'm a human being, but I also do what I perceive to be comedy. My father was a dermatologist and was the primary breadwinner, and then my mom was the homemaker, and then eventually trained to become a family therapist, but that wasn't until after I left the company. There was love. I had a really lovely childhood. I knew that we were okay. My mom took care of all the bills, and she would only get mad once in a while when she'd say, we're broke. But it was usually because of some poor decision due to compulsive shopping, you know, like, I shouldn't have gone to the Miller Hill Mall and gotten that sweater set. It was silly. My dad was a saver, so we did have a lot of powdered milk. The thermostat was at 50. He said, get a sweater, and it was chilly, very chilly in our house. Did you ever hear that biblical story? I was raised religious. It's, all the servants, or whatever, were given talents. So all of them were given one bag of gold, okay? And then the master goes, I'll see you in 6 months. And then one guy digs a hole and puts it underneath his house. And then the second guy takes a little bit of it, invests part of it, so by the end of 6 months has three bags. And then the third guy, he like spreads out everywhere, starts a business, starts employing people. It's just like, he makes like 17 bags. And then they all go back to the master, and the master's like, oh, you're the most awesome one, 17 bag man. And I remember reading that when I was a kid in like a Bible storybook, and I was like, no, he isn't. It's the guy who dug the hole and put the thing under his house. Because it's safe there. It's safe. But that's no longer how I manage my money. Number one, I don't have a basement. I have a no-fee financial advisor. I do Susie Orman. I have 12 months of prudent reserve. I'm paying down my mortgage faster. I'm not totally up to it in retirement. I'm trying to save, and I keep track of everything that I spend, even though if some of what I spend is ridiculous. I just know exactly how much I've spent. You know, if I spend, let's say, $8,000 a month on coffee, you know, that's me. That's what I need, okay? You know, that's something that makes my heart sing.
Comedian Maria Bamford wants you to know she told that Bible story to the best of her recollection. Her most recent comedy album is called Ask Me About My New God. Send us your own lessons in family finance, tweet us at LiveMoney, or record your story at MarketplaceMoney.org. And that's Marketplace Money this week. Next time, we'll talk about the personal finance of partying with world-renowned expert Andrew W.K. That and your deepest, darkest money questions answered on Marketplace Money from APM. Our show is produced by Dan Samatovich, Candice Manriquez, Raghu Manavalan, and Lindsay Foster Thomas. Brendan Willard is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Remember to always check with your financial professional before you make any big money decisions. Thanks for listening.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.